Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is Mark Chabrimuthu, co-head of direct lending at Hayfin, one of Europe's premier alternative asset managers. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Lisa.
Mark, the world is on tenterhooks. There's a war between Iran, US, and Israel, and the outcome is uncertain. It could be a prolonged disruption where energy supply from the Middle East is upended, dragging the global economies into a deep recession, or it could be over relatively quickly with hopefully minimal pain and just a small shaving off of GDP. One tweet from President Donald Trump can send oil prices plunging, equity markets soaring as it did on Monday of this week, and it's really hard to know what to do. In this backdrop, what do you do?
It's a good question. So what we ask ourselves every day. I think the first thing to say is that our job is not to predict the outcomes of a geopolitical conflict or risk. It's not to pick markets. Our job is to find the best opportunities and be the most prudent managers of capital during these periods of volatility. And if you've managed capital in Europe at any time over the last 15 years, you've been through several bouts of volatility, whether that's a sovereign debt crisis, whether it's COVID, whether it's Brexit, whether it's the Ukraine conflict and the ensuing impact on rates and inflation. You've been through periods of heightened volatility, both in the public as well as the private markets. So the stripes of a manager is really how you manage those periods of volatility.
So you would say this, all the volatility, because actually stock market is not off that much. If you look at credit spreads are not, hasn't widened that much. It's just more the temperature of the situation keeps changing back and forth. But you would equate some of this period to others in the past that you've invested in?
There are elements of the environment that we're in today which resemble certain periods we've been through. Immediately post the beginning of the Ukraine conflict, we had a spike in energy prices, particularly as we think about the gas supply into Germany and other parts of Europe. So we had to go through the analysis and review the portfolio and the things that are out in the market that we're looking at as to what the second order impacts are of a higher energy environment, the impact on potential impact on inflation. We've had to look at supply chain disruption in the past through Suez. We've looked at very sector-specific volatility, as I'm sure we'll come on to at some point during this podcast on software in other sectors. So we've been through various machinations of what we're seeing today. I think what's different about this particular period is that there's a conflation of lots of different factors all at the same time with an uncertain outcome.
So have you changed your investment thesis this coming into this year? Because we came in very bullish and there's been a lot of uncertainty, but this one is a very big one, probably the biggest, definitely the biggest so far this year. And as you said, we don't know the outcome. But likely energy prices are going to be higher. Already the central banks have telegraphed that they are at least not cutting rates and possibly even hiking. So how are you looking at your investments right now?
There's two aspects to that. There's what's happening in the portfolio and what are we doing on the new investment
funds.
And we maintain a pretty vigilant and regular review of our portfolio. What are the trends? What are the potential, let's say, exogenous factors that will impact performance? So the teams go through a review both sort of systematically on a monthly and quarterly basis, but in periods of volatility like that, we look at Apple for the whole on a more regular and in greater depth. What are the factors which may affect performance as we think about going forward? And then there's the new deal front. And we're in constant, we have over 100 investment professionals at Hayfin, making sure that the team that are on the front line sourcing and executing with sponsors, not sponsors, advisors, bank channels, really understand what's the impact of what's going on outside with what we want to do for the portfolio. We do this as a matter of course. And you go through every 12 to 18 months in Europe, there seems to be a power of volatility. So having been in existence since 2009, we've got quite used to it. But there is a heightened importance in making sure communication between the top of the house, those that are looking at the portfolio construction across our strategies, those who are in charge of managing their portfolio, and the people actually out there sourcing is tight and is coordinated. We're in periods like this, whether it's looking at software assets, whether it's looking at services which may be impacted by GenAI, whether it's looking at input prices for some of our more manufacturing-led businesses, there are themes that you pick up in the market that you really have to focus on. And in periods of volatility, particularly in the beginning of volatility, because that's the one thing we don't know. We don't know how long this is going to be. So the duration and the form of the resolution to this conflict is unknown. But at the beginning of volatility, the stance is cautiousness.
So you can have anticipated a war with Iran, but AI has been on the horizon for a while, but it has really, the new products that's come online this year has really disturbed the thesis, not so much private credit, but the thesis for private credit, especially in the US. You're seeing some of the biggest names over there selling off in that part of the market in the US. Retail flows are a much bigger component of their AUM. And they've had what's called non-traded BDC, where they attract wealthy individuals or affluent individuals for a limited number of liquidity, 5%. And you've seen subrogating or limited redemptions of those vehicles. A lot of noise, a lot of negative headlines on private credit in the US. Can you explain to me how that is manifesting in Europe? How is the state of direct lending in Europe similar, trailing, different?
I think you need to unpack some of those things. So let's take them in order. And you talked about sort of AI-related businesses and software. It's true that there is a higher proportion of software-related names in the US versus Europe.
I mean, there's some shops with 45% software.
But even in the liquid markets, you've got sort of 15% of the index in the US, 10% here in Europe. You've got 20 to 25% in most managers in the US. It's much more like 10 to 15 here. Although you're right, there are some managers who have a higher percentage of software in the book. We're at the lower end. In terms of what we have in portfolio indirect lending, it's less than 10% across all of our vintages, and actually less than 5% from the current one.
What was that, Mark? Because it seemed like people were in love with software, enterprise software companies, recurring revenue, sticky, private equity loved them. Well, how did you come into this with such a low exposure to private software?
Sure, a couple of things that happened, particularly in Europe post-22, as the market picked up and some of the higher quality, what was thought to be higher quality software names were the names that transacted that were being bought for north of 20 times. What's happening is that there's a market putting 7 times leverage and 2 times of pick on top of pretty much every software business out there, irrespective of whether it's the top of the chain in terms of quality or second or third tier assets. It became a blanket structure that 7 plus 2. And even at that point, we felt very uncomfortable putting that much.
Just was more of a leverage
on assets which are, whilst they were still growing, we're seeing even back then some softening at the top line. And so we started to be a lot more cautious about and started to put up which assets we looked at and which assets we took through the system. And so we sort of self-selected out of a lot of those more aggressive deals, and as a result, have less in the portfolio. From a GenAI perspective, we had one of the consultants come in about 18 months ago and look at our existing book and sort of going a thorough deep dive on the entire portfolio and giving us in a very consultant fashion sort of a red light, amber light, green light analysis of which of the assets in our portfolio were more susceptible to the advances in GenAI and the disruption potential for some of its businesses. Luckily, we didn't have too many red flags. Actually, we had one in particular. And when there was a refinancing of that asset, and we took the action to get it together. Now, that was a firm decision. I'm sure along the way, everyone took it to disappoint. Like, if there's a crazy, then I'm done working. It was a really attractive space. But we just, whilst we still liked that recurring, we still liked the certainly for some of the assets which are really embedded with the client's own data. But there's a correlation between how much you like an asset, how much you're willing to let it, when the returns that you're returning for them. So there's the combination and our view on the private capital structures and some more thematic views on the sector sort of led us to have less than the market. Now, if you, being very honest with you, the assets that we do have, and I think it's pretty much the same across the street, we're not actually seeing that much in either positive or negative effects. But this is what the latest iteration of Anthropic Claude has done is to really force everyone to reassess what is the potential threat, which are the assets which are going to benefit and use AI to their advantage, or those that are really going to have their business models undermined. And that is still a work in progress for everyone. And whilst we're in that position, still working out where do we think there are winners and where we think others, is it the right thing to do is to be cautious. But I come back to the I think you've been just saying around
the BDCs, the non-traded BDCs, wealth channel.
And this is where we sort of just need to take a bit of stock. Is about 25-30% of the global source of the capital for private credit in retail hands. There's about 20% of the global capital for private credit in non-traded BDCs. There's a tiny proportion if you look at what's in Europe.
Europe, it might be a blessing right now.
It's single digits.
Yes, so behind the US in this area.
Yeah, and look, there's always a lag in terms of developments in the US versus Europe. If we'd had this particular set of events and crisis in 2, 3, 4 years time, we might be having a very different conversation. But you do need to remind yourself, European managers are predominantly long-term institutional closed-end fund money. And that provides, and that the way we look at it at Safin, that gives us the privilege of actually being patient with capital. We have a 3-year investment period, and there will be a period of volatility within that 3-year investment period. There will be better times to invest, and there will be times to be more circumspect. And you only need to look back to 2022 post-Ukraine. In the quarter after conflict started and we had the impact of rates and inflation, the market here in Europe continued as nothing happened, right? It actually wasn't until Q3 that we really saw a real resetting of price, resetting of documentation, resetting of returns. And we took the view back then that we'd go slow in Q2, we'd go slow in Q3, but then accelerating Q4 when there was a price correction, when our asset class bought out of what was happening in the liquid markets. And that long-term nature of capital enables you to be patient and to understand that there are going to be periods of relative value when water accelerate. And there are going to be periods where actually the best thing to do is let things go by. And then I come back to the point I made earlier about this being the beginning. It's way too soon to be making a judgment on where the direction of travel is on credit spreads, where the direction of travel on default levels are, where the direction of travel on stress earnings. Now's the time to be patient. And the European managers have the benefit of having...
I was going to say, because the one direction of travel that is clear is outflows from retail funds in the US market. Outflows begin outflows. But to your point, I think it's like in the single digit of billions of retail money here in Europe. So even if they all fled, even if every single dime or pence left, they wouldn't have much of an impact in Europe, at least on like redemptions and liquidity. Although it might have some sense on sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have any retail. But I have heard for a few managers who do that actually they've been seeing inflows into European retail product, which goes to the discussion around US versus Europe, which really kicked off last year post Liberation Day, where the level of macro level uncertainty and the change in stance in the US led a lot of allocators to reassess where they are in terms of their own portfolio construction. And probably it was the catalyst for allocators to look at it and say, I probably should have been more balanced US versus Europe. I probably should have been more balanced private equity versus private credit. So, you know, private equity has been suffering from a lack of DPI. And so the shift in sentiment that we saw beginning of last year, which carried through all of last year, and even in a period of great volatility like today, or sentiment volatility rather than market volatility, is still actually being a tailwind to European managers, being a tailwind to people raising capital. That's what I think that's quite an interesting development.
So that's what I want to ask you next, is you talk to investors, LP, people who control huge pools of money. I know you probably aren't traveling as much. I think one of the things that I want to squash travel. People I know are stuck there. They're starting to come back. But what are the investors saying to you right now? Are they still in the mood to deploy and more to Europe? Is the Europe thesis and this argument just as valid, or is there some pulling back because Europe is closer to the conflict?
Yeah. Most of our investors are pretty sophisticated, right? And they have the ability to take that step back and go, what do I think of private credit? Number one, like, what place does private credit play in your overall financial ecosystem? And if we, and I know you've written about this, like if you think back to the progression post-GFC is to the deliberate policy and regulatory move to move capital
away from
out of banks, out of deposit-taking institutions into the private sphere. And you think about the numbers of mid and upper mid-size non-market companies that are relying on private credit that used to be serviced by banks. That tide is still as prevalent today, that the forces that are moving that are still as prevalent today as they were in 2010. And that inexorable move to move more capital away from banks and into private hands is what is the most important driver for the asset class. And yes, there will be many periods of volatility like we see today, but that driving force, that fundamental reason for the shift to private credit versus the syndicated markets or the bank-led lending, that continues. And so most of the allocators I talk to understand that that trend hasn't changed. And also that private credit tends to perform better in periods of stress.
I was going to say, in 2023-24, when interest rates were high and the banks had their underwritten loans that they couldn't sell, home deals, they were pretty much closed for shop to lend to leveraged finance companies or more heavily indebted companies. We call you guys the golden era of private credit. I know there are many people like, okay, don't call us that, don't like it. But no one could deny this period where you guys really shone and there was a lot of money coming in and really became sort of when, look, I think perhaps the common Wall Street, still don't think I could go around and ask, like at a cocktail party, what private credit is. But someone who reads the financial news, they started to understand what private credit was. Could that be a redux, or are situations with oil and with some of like, and I want to touch on some of the defaults and AI such that you don't think it could be another reiteration of the banks really stepping back and you guys outperforming?
I think, I think as an asset class, we'll still outperform in these periods of volatility in respect to what's happening at the banks. I think the difference today with the banks versus where we were in 22 is that the banks had a lot less of capital balance sheet out, in other words. So this period came quite early on before the emission really kicked on, mainly in Europe, but it's equally a little more in the US. And so it happened before there were a lot of underwriters, so there was a lot of capital being assigned for underwriters. So I think the banks feel in the world in a good place. There are two deals in the market which seem to be going pretty well, in the AM and CO there. So I think that's one of the differences. Mm-hmm. But even if you step away from that opportunity and step into their shoes, just the provision of capital, whether that's to existing portfolio companies that we have, probably largest portfolios out there, or providing capital to in assets that we think are still very high quality, they're generating cash, they're relatively insulated to some of the risks we've talked about, and is the home of private credit. 80% of all years have fueled by private credit, sorry. And so I think allocate and understand the integral place that our recruitment plays in the ecosystem and understand the strategic need to have an allocation across, whether it's direct lending all the way through to the more optimistic funds. What has become a lot more prevalent, I'd say, in the last 18, 24 months is manager selection. And so understand, as people get more familiar with some of the vagaries and volatility that we see in Europe, and some of the complexities, they preview or not pay the right manager to back. It's just become very, very high.
Already you can see the difference, right? You have Blackstone. This is all in the US where they're dealing with whether to provide all the redemption withdrawals or to limit. You have Blackstone taking a one path, Apollo, HPS, BlackRock taking another. We're also seeing different ways in which some of the portfolio, you have some really big names, have some loans that they've had to write down immediately. So to your point, so let's touch on that, which is sort of default. We came into this year with some negative headline, even before AI. Definitely before Iran, which were First Brands and Tricolor, which I know everyone in the private credit market sort of like, but that's not a private credit deal. But nonetheless, it's credit. It seems like all one, and I wrote about this, but it is credit, right? And so the idea that there is going to be defaults and there's weaknesses in credit. Talk to me about what you're seeing on the default and what, how valid a worry this is. How many more cockroaches are we going to see?
Yeah, without relitigating the cases of first.
Yes. Oh, we have a European one now too.
Right? Yeah, and first. And I think the way we look at it is one that's on the market.
Yes.
Two, it's fraud or alleged fraud. And that can happen anywhere. In any asset class, at any point in time.
Why is it happening three? Boom, boom, boom. I think that was the fear.
Well,
so does it say something about where we are in the marketplace? We're not like due diligencing enough, or is it impossible to do diligence wrong?
We're by nature very prone to drawing the line and the connection between randomly uncorrelated events. So it's natural that we look at those things and then in isolation and go, there must be something wrong. Now, could you create a thesis that we've been in a relatively active market, competition for assets is high, and therefore there may be some diminution in the care that some managers are using in investing in some assets? It's very hard to prove. I understand the theory, but what is clear is that those are non-sponsored transactions, and from a Hayfin perspective, we approach those in a different way. The level of diligence and the level of care taken in those situations, precisely because there is heightened risk of fraud, is different from how we operate on in a sponsored content of turning into non-sponsored content. And so we've developed and we've been doing non-sponsored transactions since the beginning. But we've developed a model set how to deal with those. Now, goes beyond looking at the financial diligence and the commercial diligence and the model and the budget and then going, well, ask them to wish the manager going, oh, that goes into really investigating what are the practices of this team, what are the practices, what's the governance with the founder? Are there any signs of risk-taking behavior which are not in line with the behaviors that we would want from our management teams? And the question then begs is, does everyone do the same? But it's really hard to litigate. But then you also need to take some back. Three instances in a market that's putting in, almost $2 trillion in value today. It's sort of being a little bit on it. It does maybe remind people that underwriting standards are better. And that from an allocator's perspective, really understanding your underwriting philosophy and practices of your managers, really understanding how they deal with diligence, how to get on with skin of businesses, that's become more important.
So if fraud's not your biggest worry, because in some ways they don't happen that often and they're rare and it's hard to fight against it, or at least underwrite for it, what is your biggest worry right now? When there's so many things going on. I'm going to limit you to one.
One thing.
Because it could be so many
I think we talked about it earlier. It's the potential impact of Gen AI and agentic.
Okay, so AI. For you, more AI than the energy. Okay.
And why is that? The world has been through periods of high inflation, high rates, actually more than the traditional cost. We've learned to navigate those periods. Companies have managed to navigate those periods of development. Higher input prices is not an unusual or certainly unprecedented event. The impact or the potential impact on Gen AI and agentic on how businesses operate, how services businesses operate, which how workflows have been changed, how the pyramids of people and some people have their businesses that we look at. And that is unprecedented. And as we said before, we're not seeing any impact today, but we know there will be. We know that will be there. There will be some assets which will benefit. And there'll be assets that where their business models are rendered obsolete. And that uncertainty and this interfering period where we're trying to work out what's the right frame. What are the assets that we absolutely don't want to look at? What are the assets that we're prepared to look at? What are the assets that we're really going to like in a world where there is relatively low volume because of the other factors we talked about? That's the challenge which I worry about, team worries about, we talk about all the time. And it goes back to the start. Today is the day to be cautious. It's just tread carefully and back people that you rate.
So you have a really great sponsor that you rate. They come to you and say, we want to leverage buyout a software company. Is that a discussion or is it like, no, that
it,
you guys...
It absolutely is a discussion. It absolutely is a discussion. If it's a sponsor, we have them, right? We have them. We have sponsors.
But new ones, right?
So we have relationships with sponsors who have an excellent track record in software. And they've developed patterns of learning and laboratories within their own ecosystem of portfolio companies where they're sharing best practice. And they're seeing the impact much sooner than we are, right? Because they're at the forefront with their managers, with their management teams. So that's number one, backing something that knows what they're doing. Is that's almost a cynical answer, something that we would. And then we look at the business model and we've been through this one recently. Help us understand why this is more insulated than others out there. We've looked at help us how embedded this platform is with its customers, how what's different about the ownership of data in this particular asset. What's the protected moment around the end customer and the usage of this for the technology. So there are lots of stages you can go through with someone that really understands what they're doing. We weren't involved, but there was a software deal that traded last week. The asset was bought for 20 times. The lender put 7 times the leverage on it, and it was at relatively good spread. But what does it stop doing? So it's not like activity level is complete in a sense of even in software.
That's really much more.
But it has moderated, and everyone is being much more judicious about who you back. So if that call comes in, we absolutely take that call.
Okay.
We absolutely give it the due care and attention. But you wouldn't be surprised that the bar of diligence and the bar of conviction of both the business launch and ultimately that's what the committee is just that much higher today than it was before.
So beyond software, one thing that this kind of volatility does, it does squash deal activity, LBOs. I think people thought last year, LBOs were supposed to roar back. Sponsors were ready to put money to work. And then we had Liberation Day and they put pencil down and they didn't pick them up for a while. And now they're always hearing this year again, oh, they're ready. They're like ready to deploy. And we've got this shock. It's pencil down again. Do you think they'll pick it up? When do you think they'll pick it up? I know it's hard to do it, but at least... What do you do when your biggest customer is penciled out?
Well, a couple of things. One, penciled out. Right. So are the levels of M&A activity, are they the same that we saw coming into Q4 and out of it, where we had a very heavy period of deployment? No, of course not. But that's not to say there's zero activity.
Okay.
And so there's still a nice steady slew very attractive companies that are going to be climate. Is it the same heavy volume that we saw sort of coming on to the end of this past year? Well, there is still activity. Second thing, in periods like this where you see lower levels of and that's when you really rely on the portfolio. And that's where it's the larger managers that tend to navigate these periods better. Why? Because they've got a lot of portfolio. Those companies will be adults and the contributor core. They'll trade, right? The higher quality assets within the portfolio. And you've got an inside perspective on the quality of the business, the resilience of the earnings, how it will impact, how it will fall in more volatile and an area, and periods, sorry. So you rely a little bit more on the portfolio in this period. But that's not to say that the new names we've been deploying in Q1. We have a handful of logos tied to the portfolio. It's and we have a lot of support from now existing portfolio. So it's easy to look at the headlines and go, everyone, you know, the market's shut, no one's doing anything, everyone's just waiting for the resolution. It's not actually the case.
And my final question is that a lot of the things rhymes with what's happened in the past, but not at this pace. This pace of change is so rough. It feels like the market's been hit with one thing after another. So when you come into the office, what is exciting for you?
There are lots of different answers to that question, sorry.
You'd be like, not excited at all.
there's the excitement of what's going on in the market. Mm-hmm. There's the excitement of really trying to distill where do we want to spend time.
Mm-hmm.
How do you orientate our investment professionals to help them continue to assess assets within the context of what's going on? That's exciting to actually to adapt to the changes in the market. And that's the full work of a great manager. How it's not to sit on your hands and do nothing. It's really to assess what's going on and adapt. And that may be a shift in level of activity from direct lending to the opportunistic side of the house. And are you thinking about the liquid credit market? So that's quite exciting. And then from a personal perspective, we're on a growth trajectory. We've just gone through our buyout.
Yeah.
We're now owners of our assets, with the majority of those of our assets.
Does it make you work harder? Are you working longer hours now?
it makes it more personal.
Mm-hmm.
People are asking, like, this there, that element of ownership and that element of collective desire to grow business as to how it become more institutionalized and more thoughtful about how we do things now that we have brains. That's really exclusive. That's what gets most people at the
Nick, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us. And do follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next week. This has been Lisa Lee.